Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
As we wrap up 2024, the pop culture experts at Consequence are back with our annual report, celebrating the year's best in music and entertainment. And this time, we're bringing you something extra, a brand new podcast series exclusively on Amazon Music. Get inside access with interviews featuring the year's biggest artists, actors, and filmmakers, plus discussions with the Consequence team on our best of the year lists. You can tune in with Amazon Music Unlimited, now free for 3 months. For a limited time, get 3 months of Amazon Music Unlimited free by visiting tryamazonmusic.com/COS. You'll get over 100 million songs in stunning HD sound on demand and ad-free, plus top ad-free podcasts, including the Consequence Annual Report podcast. Even better, every Amazon Music Unlimited subscriber now gets one free audiobook from Audible each month. So celebrate the best of 2024 with Consequence's Annual Report all December at consequence.net. And don't miss the companion podcast by signing up for 3 free months of Amazon Music Unlimited at tryamazonmusic.com/COS or clicking the link in the show description. That's tryamazonmusic.com/COS.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hi.
I'm Brandon.
I'm Mike.
We're from the band Incubus, and we are giving you the story behind the song on Consequence.
Welcome, listeners, to The Story Behind the Song. I'm your host, Peter Chatti of Deep Cuts Media. Incubus is a band born out of L.A. in the mid-1990s, and with an endless string of massive hits at the end of that decade and well into the next. Two of their biggest were Drive from their 1999 third album, Make Yourself, a song that spent 60 weeks on the Billboard charts and went all the way to number 2, and Wish You Were Here from their fourth album, Morning View, in 2001. And to mark the 23rd anniversary of Morning View, the band just recently released Morning View 23, their fresh re-recording and reimagination of that song and others on that classic album. And in this week's episode, I'm joined by two members of that great band that now are on the road, likely in a town near you. Vocalist Brandon Boyd and lead guitarist Mike Einziger, who co-founded the band during high school days in Calabasas. They both joined me to discuss it all, their music, where it came from, and their journey ever since. It's candid, fresh, and fascinating from two great musicians and one great band that refused to settle in or settle down. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind two classic Incubus songs, Drive and Wish You Were Here, with Brandon Boyd and Mike Einziger.
So first of all, guys, welcome. And where are you both today?
We are freshly home from an Australia-Asia tour. We just got home a few days ago. So we're both at our respective houses.
A little jet lagged.
A little woozy, but yeah,
it's all good though.
Yeah, I bet. When was your last tour?
Prior to that.
Oh, before that.
Yeah.
We toured in the U.S. All the way through the summertime of 2023, ending in our last show of that tour was at the Hollywood Bowl on October 6th.
Oh, that's very cool. How was that to play the bowl?
It's always a pleasure to play there.
Yeah, it was surreal.
It's amazing. We actually played Morning View from front to back, and it was a really wild, very memorable experience for us, and hopefully it was that way for the audience too. It seemed like everyone that attended had a wonderful time. They sang really, really loud, and it was a gorgeous night. Really couldn't have asked for anything better.
Yeah.
It was pretty great. We both grew up going to concerts there, so to play there even once, I think we played there maybe four or five times now, And every time it's sort of like, can't believe that you're playing at the Hollywood Bowl. This is amazing.
Yeah.
We came here as children. So it's pretty great.
It's such a great venue. You know, you guys and your music is very personal in a sense that I spent a lot of my years in Laurel Canyon. And so when all this great music was coming out, I'd be driving around and it would be constant on K-Rock. And, you know, both the albums we're talking about, and you have so many hits, but both the albums that we'll be talking about are double platinum, and just the songs are, I think a lot of people try to place bands and artists into specific genres, and you have your own sound, and that's what makes it so cool. Tell us a little bit about your journeys together, guys, getting the band together, how it all came to be.
Well, we were in high school when we started playing together, but, you know, Brandon and Jose were in school together from the time they were in elementary school, starting, I believe, in like first grade or kindergarten or whatever age.
We met in third or fourth grade. It was at elementary.
Cool. Like right there. That's very cool.
And then I met Brandon and Jose when we were in sixth grade together. Brandon and I were in the same gifted kids program. That's where Brandon and I met each other. It was called Gate, and we were in the same class there. So that's really how we met. You know, Jose was part of our friend group, and, you know, we were all just kind of surfing skate rat kids together. And then when we got into high school, we started the band together when we were in 10th grade. We just kind of all shared mutual interests, and there was this one sort of condensed period of time where, you know, my stepdad played drums and he had a drum set, and Jose really wanted to play the drums. So we kind of stole my stepdad's drum set, brought it over to Jose's house, started jamming around. It was this one weekend when Jose's parents were out of town, and we were like, oh, great, we can make noise all weekend. And then very shortly after that was like, you know, Brandon and I were in like a wood shop class together. And also in our English class together. So we were in proximity like a lot of the time. And then this one time it was just like, hey, like let's make music. And we all just sort of descended upon my mom's living room, and that was it. Like we started writing songs like immediately together as a band, started playing in people's backyards at parties, and graduated from there to shithole clubs in the valley. There was a place called Mancini's that's no longer there. There was a place called the Country Club that's no longer there. These were kind of dangerous spots, actually. The reason why they got closed down was because of shootings and stabbings and things like that, you know, which is all super exciting to a bunch of 15, 16 year old kids. And
immersion into the dark underbelly of Los Angeles.
You know, rock and roll is supposed to be a little dangerous, you know, so.
Holy. It was literally dangerous, and we were literally children, like, cool, let's play here, like, if they'll have us.
I mean, Brandon got his driver's license before the rest of us did, so he kind of, like, you know, was, like, the responsible parent taking us from place to place, if you could, if you can imagine that.
I was the one born in February in 1976, so I got mine first.
Yeah, Jose wasn't until April, and I wasn't until June, so Brandon was, like, you know, our ride places. And then, you know, being sort of, you know, LA natives, it was natural for us to graduate from playing those shitty clubs and parties to like playing at places like the Whiskey and the Roxy and the Troubadour, which, you know, we got to know all of those folks really well. And somehow, some way, we were packing those places when we were 16 years old with other 16-year-olds. So they weren't drinking at the bar and making them all that bar money, but for whatever reason, we would just fill those clubs. You know, often like every like week or two, we did that a lot for a good period of time.
You guys are gifted kids. So your parents are, you know, probably quite involved in your lives and all that kind
of stuff.
That's
one way of describing it. And, maybe.
Okay. Here you guys are all buddies, gifted kids. You're going to these dangerous underbelly kind of clubs and you're still in high school.
Yep.
And you're like 16 doing this kind of stuff. So how did your parents feel about that?
They didn't have much say in the matter.
Yeah.
I mean, like by the time you're 16, at least here in Los Angeles in the early 90s, it was sort of like, we didn't have cell phones. We, you know, we were just.
That's true.
I think maybe I know that Michael and I share coming from broken homes in common. I think that our parents were embroiled in sort of long, embittered sort of divorce processes. Wow. And so it was right around this period of time. So we were, part of us leaning into each other and into writing music as a band was sort of like a, I didn't realize it at the time, but as a full grown adult now, it occurs to me that like we were escaping into music with each other from the weirdness in our households. And so I think our parents just recognizing that we were alive and coming home at night, it was like, you're alive. Okay, good. You're alive. Great. Yeah. Your eyeballs aren't hanging on your face. Great. I can't handle anything else. So we were like, we were probably growing up faster.
Yeah.
As a result of all of these circumstances, not only being in a band, playing in places where we legally weren't supposed to be, and you know, escaping familial traumas and stuff at home, all these things combined probably forced a swifter rise into young adulthood. But the funny thing about playing in some of those clubs, like when we were filling up the Roxy and the Whiskey and the Troubadour and all these clubs, it was a period of time in LA. I don't know if it's still the same way, but you would basically buy tickets from the club, then you could just sell them at for however you, much you wanted. And so we were like, how much is a concert ticket? Like $5. And so Jose and I bonded very, very early around a love of illustration and drawing. And so we started hand drawing all these flyers and spending all this time like designing Incubus logos. And they were, they're really crappy now that I'm looking back on them, but they're very creative. And we were like, you know, cutting and pasting and using hand-drawn fonts and all these things. And they looked, it looked like a cool thing to come to. And we were taking our cues from the concert posters from the 60s and the 70s from like Rick Griffin and Stanley Mouse and these guys who we had no access to other than like looking through books from like Grateful Dead posters and Big Brother and Holding Company and Jefferson Airplane, all these, but we would just see these things and it just seemed like this magical world. And it felt like the flyer for the show was as important as the show. And so we put all this effort into it. And then Mikey had a, what do they call the thing where you cut pieces of paper at the same time.
Yeah, one of those big paper cutters.
The paper cutter bit. He had one of those. There was a Kinko's down the street. And then so it was a thing. It was like this continual project. And Jose and I would draw these flyers. All of us would go there and we'd hang out at Kinko's for like 4 hours while we photocopied 1,000 of them. We'd go to Mike's house and cut them. And then it'd be like, call Mikey's phone number for your $5 ticket. And then people would call. We would arrange, we'd sell them a ticket and we would sell at these clubs. But the part I'm trying to get to was that the club would put us on random bills. We were opening for bands that were like in their 30s that were like, and it was like the last vestiges of like hair metal. So we were opening for these hair metal bands at these clubs. The room would completely fill up with high school students. It'd be a huge mosh pit. It'd be this fucking crazy show. And then the room would clear out after us. So we were the band. Wow. We got kind of a bad reputation with these older bands because it was like their audience sucks. They won't stick around. Yeah. Remember this, Mike?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we felt a little bad sometimes because there were these bands that, you know, were really like, you could tell they had put a lot of money and effort into these like set designs and stuff. And the place would be so packed when we'd play. And like, I think those guys would be like, oh, this is going to be so great. Look how many people showed up for us. The second we got off stage, it would be just like two or three people like, yeah. All right.
Oh, man.
It's just high school kids, though, because the place where we had this leg up was that we were still in high school. Yeah. And high school kids are bored and looking for trouble. You know what I mean? So
we gave them something to do. We
gave them something to do.
Entertainment for these people.
Yeah, and it was $5. So it was just like a no-brainer. And the shows were so fun. They were so crazy. Like people were, they were getting to know our music in real time, like while we were playing it for them. And then we would subsidize our Sunset Strip shows with countless backyard keggers. If someone had a keg, they'd be like, we'll get Incubus to play. And then we would go and play in their backyard. And so that became this thing.
Couches getting lit on fire and like mosh pits around flaming pieces of furniture. And, you know, this is before social media. None of this shit could happen today. Like, it just...
Yeah, it would be shut. The parents would shut it down.
It would get shut down. It was really fun and exciting. And we genuinely connected with a young culture that was hungry for whatever it was that we were able to offer them. And
we were as much part of the culture as they were. It was our culture, you know what I mean? This is just our friends.
And it always had a feeling like there was a trajectory. Like, it was always moving forward in some direction. And it, luckily for us, you know, being local Los Angeles kids, the music industry really started taking notice of what we were doing, because there weren't very many bands that were like an unknown local artist that would show up and just sell out a show like that. So the word spread very quickly that we were like a real thing. And before we knew it, it was like we were getting flown around by, you know, Sony and MCA and Virgin Records and all these people like trying to get in our business. And it created a unique situation for us as young kids to be able to help kind of determine what our future was going to be as a band, as a career.
When they started to fly you around, do you remember a moment in time where it wasn't just Keggers anymore and just, you know, there was something that happened, like an event where you thought, damn.
Yeah, for sure. There were a bunch of events that happened around that time. Our parents were always kind of like, what are you guys doing? You know, like, I think they maybe trusted us like a tiny bit, but we seemed very, we had a definitive direction. Like, I started working at a recording studio as soon as I could drive. And sort of through that, I ended up getting recruited to work at Interscope Records, where I worked for Jimmy Iovine and Tom Wally for years. And as soon as that happened, you know, all these other record labels were starting to show up at our shows, and the word just got around really quickly. Actually, one of the more exciting things that happened for us was we got the opportunity to open up for the band Primus at the Santa Barbara Bowl. And we were an unsigned, unknown band at the time. And it was like, wow, for us, like, that was a really big deal. Primus was like one of our favorite bands, especially at that time. And that all happened, you know, through our folks at Interscope, and they made that happen for us. And that was like, to me, that was like, okay, like we're like, people sort of take us seriously. And then very, very soon after that, you know, people were sort of throwing record deals at us, and it was a great problem to have, but we had to sit down, find, you know, legal representation, and sort of decode how a young band handles sort of formally entering into the music business, and, you know, without getting completely fucked, which is what happens to most young artists at that time.
That's the normal story. I think that we did a pretty good job of navigating that, but we also, to our credit, there were like big record deals that were getting put on the table where they would have offered us like huge advances and a lot of like perks and things like that. And, you know, they were the sort of proverbial shiny object in front of us. We took the much less shiny object in the form of like a development deal from Immortal Records, which was a subsidiary of Epic, which was under Sony. We took a deal that was going to allow us to stay on the road, that would just give us like tour support, where we could just play as many shows as possible and slowly develop as a band, slowly develop our songwriting skills. We were still teenagers when we got signed. We were still
crazy.
We were teenagers when we went on our first major tour to, when we were just out of teenagedom when we went on tour with Korn in Europe in 1997. So, and we'd only been out of high school for 3 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we started touring internationally, and we didn't have any, like, you know, we had released singles that had gone to college radio stations at the time, but there was nothing sort of commercially viable about us at that moment. And so there was some intuition that we had a bigger day ahead of us. And so we didn't take the big shiny object in front of us. We're like, let's bet on ourselves and take this a little more slowly. It ended up being the right decision.
One of the things that you mentioned, Brandon, was you put so much into the visual of it, and you felt like that attracted people too. So did the name Incubus, was it stylistic in your mind? Is that how it came to you guys, that it would make for some great art too?
I wish I could say that it was. It was just completely random how we decided on that band name. If I am recalling correctly, I think Mikey opened up a thesaurus and just sort of went, covered his eyes and did one of these. You know, does that sound about right, Mike?
It was. I just remember that we were looking in the thesaurus and the word incubus was next to the word spirit. Mm-hmm. And I think that at the time we were like trying to come up with all these band names, and it was like really challenging to find something that hadn't like already been copywritten or like used by somebody else. And we just thought like, oh, that's a cool word. No one will ever use this. And then we decided to go with it. And then we kind of hated it for a while and tried to change it a bunch of times, but people liked our music, and we had kind of quickly gathered a reputation for being a band that like people wanted to see. So we were like, all right, well, I guess we're stuck with it. And it just stayed with us for, you know, now 30 plus years.
Isn't that wild? It's so wild. Like the coolest thing of when I'm talking to artists such as yourself is that there's always so much serendipity into everything. And so you just happened to be looking at the thesaurus at that time, that name came across. If you did it the 3 hours later, it might be a completely different word. And here you are 30 years later, and that's your identity. And it's just amazing how that happens.
Most artists have this opportunity to kind of like learn by trial and error what aesthetically sort of works for them. And they're in like, you know, a bunch of shitty bands before they like kind of figure out like something that works really well and is, you know, like more timeless and whatever. We didn't have that luxury. The very first thing we ever tried to do somehow fucking worked. And so we're stuck with our 15-year-old aesthetic for the rest of our lives, for better or worse. I can't complain about it because it's been great to us. But like, you know, normally you get like a few tries at like, you know, getting it right and like, oh, learn from the one that sucked or like whatever. But it's like, nope, this first one is like the one that is going to be your, this is your thing forever. And here you go.
Let's get into Wish You Were Here from 2001's album Morning View, which is now you have created something entirely new based on that, celebrating its 23rd year, which is crazy, 23 years. So you had just a couple years earlier recorded your other album, Make Yourself, and that was from 1999, and that was a very big hit. What was your state of mind as a band at that time? Now you've reached this great success.
We should have felt a great deal of pressure and stress, but somehow we were able to kind of deflect all of those things. It seems very logical that we would have had some concern about repeating the success of Make Yourself. I remember very distinctly, we toured Make Yourself for like almost 2 years. So when we came home, and it was time to start writing a new record, which was really quickly after coming home from being on tour for almost 2 years. I think part of us, we were kind of tired, but we were also in our early 20s. So we were like, it's like early 20s tired.
Yeah.
You have one good night's sleep and then you're like rejuvenated.
Yeah.
So we had this, like you said, Make Yourself. It was doing really, really, really well. And there was definitely this feeling of momentum. It felt like the wind was at our back, which was a very, very cool feeling after working so hard. But it was a slow build. The first single we released was Pardon Me, which kind of debuted with a little bit of a thud. Some people were kind of excited about it. Some radio stations picked it up, but it wasn't like climbing the charts.
Does that concern you guys? Do you think of it that way as a band at the time? Like, damn, you know.
I didn't No, I didn't know what was supposed to be. These are things that I truly never concerned myself with. I wasn't concerned about what our chart position was going to be, how many records we were going to sell. I didn't really have any sort of real metric around that kind of thing. I just knew what I thought sounded cool. And I think Mikey can probably attest to that as well. We didn't know what bands were the most successful. We just knew what we thought was cool. And so we made something that we thought was cool. And it got a little bit of airplay, which was more airplay than we'd ever gotten, which was great for us. And so we were out on tour with Primus, if I'm not mistaken, Mike. And then we went and did, we started to go to radio stations in the morning. When we'd get to the city, we would wake up at like 7 a.m. and Mikey and I, with an acoustic guitar, would go into these radio stations and we'd play acoustic live on the air. And then that night we would do the show. We were opening up for Primus. We went and did an acoustic version of Pardon Me, which we kind of just came up with on the spot. We were like, sure, we can do this acoustic. And I sang it like an octave down, and Mikey figured out a way to make it sort of transferable to an acoustic guitar, which seems completely counterintuitive when you think about the kind of song that Pardon Me is. And it was cool. And that got played. The acoustic version started getting played a lot. And then we started getting tons of requests for us to come into radio stations like every morning when we were on tour, which was fun and exciting, but it was also really exhausting because we were recovering from the show from the night before. It's like, wake up, do it immediately in the morning, do it again at night. But then on the heels of the acoustic version doing really well, the actual single, the album version, started getting played a lot. And then after that, we released a song called Stellar, which we did a music video for. It was like the first like expensive music video we ever made. And then that started getting played
It got on TRL.
Yeah. That was wild.
There was like a very interesting, like, now that I look back on it, like, logical progression. I mean, actually, now that I look back on it, it seems insane. But at the time it was happening, it seemed logical. Because as Brandon mentioned, Pardon Me came out as a single, kind of just didn't really do much in terms of a single. But we felt like we were building. Like, every live show we played was getting bigger and more kind of crazy than the last. And when we started getting all these requests to play acoustic, if you remember, Brandon, at the time, like, alternative rock music was like really heavy. And so this sounds crazy to say now, no artists were coming in and playing acoustic at radio stations. Like, for us to come in and play an acoustic version of Pardon Me was like, whoa, they can do that? Because all the heavy, heavy, aggressive music that was really popular at that time was not conducive to that. So it was kind of like something that differentiated us from everyone else was the fact that we could just come in and play acoustic. And we offered to do it. And radio stations were like, wow, we get our own performance. It's unique. So they started playing that. And as Brandon said, that started getting played a lot. And then K-Rock started playing the original version, the album version of Pardon Me. And then it got put into full rotation at MTV. And I remember very specifically, we were selling like 6,500 records a week for us, which was really strong. That was a great, like, that was a lot of growth for us. But then once it got on TRL, or sorry, just once Pardon Me got put on MTV and it's like regular rotation.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
We went from selling 6,000 records in 1 week to 175,000 records the week after. It was just like, boom. And it didn't stop. That didn't stop. That just kept accelerating. And then our single Stellar came out after that. and that got on TRL, and that 175,000 records became like 250 a week, and we just kept clocking them in until we had sold several million records. And then Drive came out. At the end of that, we were done with our tour, and we were already in the studio working on Morning View, and Drive was the biggest it had ever been. And so we had this huge tailwind. And like Brandon was saying, maybe we should have felt pressure. But the thing is that if you go back to the way that we made Make Yourself, we had been working with a producer named Jim Wirt, who produced our recordings up until that point. And about a week into the recording of Make Yourself, we realized as a band that, you know, and I hate to say this because I love Jim. He's the sweetest guy, amazing producer. We wouldn't have been where we were without him. But it kind of felt like we were ready to move on. Like we needed to either not have a producer or just part ways. And about a week or two into it, was one of the hardest decisions that I've ever had to face as a musician. But I remember having to say, "Hey Jim, we're gonna do something different now," and having to call the people at our record company and say, "Hey, we just, you know, let go of the producer that you hired to be in the studio with us. Like, we know what we're doing. We're going to record this album without a producer." And luckily, the A&R person at Epic Records, who we were dealing with, his name was Kaz, and he fully trusted us. And, you know, it's expensive to be in recording studios. So they're, you know, shelling out tens of thousands of dollars for us to rent this room to record in. And we made the entire album of Make Yourself without any external producer at all. We had an engineer we were working with. And at the very end of it, I managed to convince Scott Litt, who had produced all the REM records, produced Nirvana Unplugged. He was someone that I was kind of trying to bring in the whole time, but he had some conflicts going on and some other stuff going on that made it difficult. But I remember bringing him into the studio and playing him Drive, playing him, you know, Stellar, playing him Pardon Me. And he was just like, "Okay, you know, I'll help you guys." And he came in for like the final stage and then helped us mix that record. And, you know, we gave him a production credit on the record, although it should have said produced by Incubus, whatever. We didn't give a fuck at the time. But I think that confidence in our vision is also what propelled us to do what we did on Morning View. So we had, you know, all this success with Make Yourself going into Morning View, and all of it was indicative of a specific sort of trajectory that we were on. And, you know, we had a vision and we wanted to fulfill it. And luckily for us, it all fell into place.
Yeah, Make Yourself was so big. It must have been like transformational in many ways, just in your own lives, right? So you have that big success. And then it's, tell us about the process of just your songwriting as a band that led to the new album Morning View, and then, you know, got, and then maybe if you could get into when you remember together the kernel that came to be Wish You Were Here. Like,
Wish You Were Here was sort of late in the process, wasn't it?
It was. It was actually the very last song that we wrote for Morning View. But just going back to Make Yourself for a second, Make Yourself really set the stage, at least for me, from the songwriting perspective, was like each one of these songs that we wrote, they all seemed to be special. They were like nuggets, like little shiny golden nuggets. They were unique. Each one had a different sound. And then, you know, I remember like kind of writing these like chord progressions and then sharing them with Brandon, and Brandon would just pour his heart out, you know, on these musical ideas. And they all felt really special and unique in different ways. And, you know, we went into a recording studio, which turned out to be Hans Zimmer's recording studio. Before ever meeting, Hans is a very close friend of mine, knows all the guys in the band. You know, like, I've done a lot of work with him in the past. I didn't know him yet at that time, but we had written the Warmth, Pardon Me, a handful of songs for Make Yourself. And we went into this studio, and we had recorded them in a really shitty rehearsal studio with like kind of like the worst gear you could use, but they were well recorded for that. We went in and mixed them, at Hans's studio, and they sounded fucking awesome. And that is actually, I think, what enabled like our record label and Kaz and the people that we were working with at Epic to say, okay, you guys can continue doing what you're doing, because there was already evidence that it was going to be great. And then when we went in to do Morning View, it was kind of like sort of just a continuation of that process. Like, we got home from all of our touring with Make Yourself, and then, like, you know, I remember handing Brandon a disc. I actually think I have it somewhere.
Oh, you got to release that.
I have it. I have it too, Mike. I have the CD of your, it was like 7 or 8 guitar. It had Echo on it. It may have had an early iteration of Nice to Know You. It was a handful of things that became, it was just the, versions it of was the guitar
riffs. It was like guitar riffs with like a click, with like a metronome. It was just like, and I would leave it like that on purpose as to not like, because the way writing these songs was, is like, for me, it was like unwrapping a present. And I want to unwrap the whole thing at one time. You know, it was really fun to go through that process. So I would just like record these guitar riffs to like just a click, just something to keep time to. And then I'd send them to Brandon, and he would come back with like, you know, these awesome lyrics. And then the rest of it would kind of like, it was like unwrapping a present. Like, when we'd all get in the room and, you know, start like putting in drum beats and listening to what the bass sounded like. It was all like this fun process. And I think that at that point, we all just had so much confidence in our own vision for what that could be, that I didn't feel pressure from the outside. Like, I felt the pressure coming from ourselves, like to make great music. And our experience, I think, was that if we felt a certain way about it, that our audience would also share that feeling with us. And that was, I think, our compass.
Mm-hmm. With Wish You Were Here, I remember when we had written most of the record at this point, and we were, you know, in this house, in this living room, writing together. And I remember when we started messing around with the musical arrangement for Wish You Were Here. We had been at the house now for a few months, and we had this opportunity to really be in that house and in that environment. And it was on PCH in like northern Malibu. And the house was, it's still there. It's this like, it's this beautiful mess. It's like a mansion in the old school sense of the word, but it's like been in disrepair for decades now. It was in disrepair when we commandeered it, but it had a vibe. It was like, sort of parts of it were like falling apart, but it had electricity. There were parts of it where like water was coming into the house, but there was this weird fountain grotto thing where frogs would congregate at night.
Yeah,
and that's how we got that, like the frog sound at the end of the album. We literally hung a SM57 down from a balcony and then just pushed record and left it, and came back in the morning, and we had like hours of frog singing.
That's epic right there. That's epic.
Yeah, we had to trick them though. We put a mic out, and we were like, wait, and then they wouldn't do it for us. So we had to just leave the microphone hanging and push record, and then we came back in the morning. Anyway, Wish You Were Here. We had that one just sort of spilled out of us. I remember hearing the riff that's like the, you know, the intro thing and the chorus riff. And then especially, Mike, your delay affected verse guitar work. And I was from a lyrical perspective, songwriting perspective, part of an indelible part of my experience with being at Morning View is that I was going through a breakup. And it was, I had broken someone's heart, but I was also heartbroken at the same time. It was an interesting thing, but we were also experiencing so much abundance in our lives as a band. And personally, it was like this amazing time that was, for me, was sort of had a shadow attached to it, that there was like this lingering kind of melancholy, for lack of a better word, or maybe that's the perfect word. So it was beautiful and sad all at the same time for me as a young man. And so I just remember hearing that riff. I started humming the melody that became, you know, that's the melody on the song now. And I walked across the street onto the beach on this beautiful night. And I was like kind of having a very sort of sensory tactile experience of looking at the water and squishing my toes in the kind of dewy sand at night there. And it was kind of chilly and there was a breeze, but it was beautiful. And I was in that moment of, I was sad, but I was also like, this is so fucking beautiful. God, I wish someone was here to share this with me.
He was talking about me.
The song's about Mikey.
Yeah.
Sounds like generally, Mike, you would be creating these chord progressions and then Brandon, you would come in and it would flow out of you. And so it was never like you forced yourself to write. It was just a very natural process all along the way, which is not necessarily a typical thing.
It was just how we interacted with each other. It was very...
It's still how we interact with each other, by the way.
It was very...
That's how we play.
It was very reactionary, you know? Like, yeah. It's kind of like, you put your hand here, I'll put my hand here, and then this, your hand goes like this, and we just keep going until it's done.
Part of that may be just you guys go back so far that there's, you're like family, you know, there's so much trust there that, you know, that's a really cool thing. So thanks for laying that all out.
And also one more thing of note was that we got to the pretty much like the end of the recording process of Morning View. And I remember like we were all sitting around and we were all kind of like, we need one more song. Like we just did, like, it was like, we just need one more song. And that was when we wrote With You Are Here. It was, we just needed one more.
It was right at the end of the whole thing. One more song. Okay, here's one more song.
And that was it. Yeah, it's crazy.
Can I just add one more tiny little story to the end of this, which is not a small part of the life of this song. Wasn't it the first single off the album, Mike, Wish You Were Here?
Yep.
So, we made a video at this point. Once again, this is in the early 2000s. And for your listeners or viewers, the record industry was very willingly spending just incredible sums of money on music videos because it was the way to get it was the vehicle to get the music out to the masses. So I think we spent like $300,000 on a music video for Wish You Were Here.
It was like $1 million.
Wow.
Okay. It was somewhere between 300,000 and a million.
Million.
So we worked with this director and his vision was we were going to recreate a film from, I think it was from the early 70s. It's a film called Head. It was directed by Jack Nicholson and it was of the Monkees. And we were going to recreate this film as sort of an homage to this film Head about the Monkees.
Are you talking about the Monkees, the band the Monkees?
Yes.
Yeah.
In this film, the band is being chased by hordes of rabid fans. And the only thing to do is for them to get to this bridge and jump off this bridge into the water where they encounter mermaids and the mermaids save them. Just very sort of random psychedelia. We're like, this is a great music video. We should do this. So we did it. And we spent all the money of us being chased by fans and I take my shirt off on this bridge and we all jump off of this huge bridge and we did this stunt where we jumped down and then there's a trampoline where we're kind of flying and it's us descending into this body of water. We get into the body of water and we're kind of unconscious and then these beautiful psychedelic mermaids come and save us. Then 9/11 happened.
Wow. Yeah.
And the music video was deemed inappropriate because of the imagery of people leaping to their deaths from the Twin Towers. And our video had us jumping off this bridge and there was images of us falling. It was deemed inappropriate. It was banned from MTV. And so in a kind of scramble, our record label was like, you got anything else? And we had been filming each other on crappy early digital video with our video cameras at the Morning View house and just filming random stuff like home video type stuff of us just joking around, us recording. And they gave us like, I think it was like 36 hours to come up with a new music video. And I tried my hand for the first time at editing, and I edited together home footage of us at the Morning View house mixed with the performance footage of us that we had filmed on green screen for the video. So we got to use that stuff. That became the music video. And they were like, great, it's your music video. And it was like kind of shitty, but like kind of amazing that we pulled it together so fast. And everyone in the band was like, great, great, let's see what happens. And we put it out and it did fine. I think the original version might have played in like Japan or something, but if anybody can find it, it's kind of fun and funny.
I'm really glad you told that story too. It's so amazing how just the authenticity of that, the organic nature of that, the fans reacted to it. I got to jump to Animali just for a second, because I can vividly remember, like I have a memory in my mind of my 7-year-old daughter in the backseat of the car. And we're driving around and Animali's on and we're both singing the song. You know, we're both singing we're singing the chorus, and my 7-year-old daughter, who's like hardcore music, we still exchange notes all the time about music, like cool music and all that kind of stuff. So I got to ask you, the song is very Baroque, you know, Baroque, like highly romantic. That's the way it's always kind of seemed to me, like very stylistic. Who is Animali?
I was in a period of time in my life where I had this vision of sorts of what I suppose an ideal partner would be like. You know, as we grow up, we learn that that's more sort of a product of our projections and our fantasies than anything. But it occurred to me based on my experiences leading up to that moment that if this person existed, if she was real, if there was going to be a potential for her to exist in my life, that she would have to be something that was completely unique and surprising, almost to the point of being like an anomaly of sorts in the world, someone so unique to my experience, at least, that it was as if she was fantastical. So I had this vision in my mind, and hence the lyric, picture your face at the back of my eyes. It's a very strange thing, the way that love and intimacy operate. You know, it's a thing that people have been writing books about and songs about and films about and plays about for time immemorial. Like it's a topic of human experience that is of infinite interest to people, and I am no exception. Like I've been confounded and fascinated by love and intimacy my entire adult life, and probably as you know, as a child too. You know, because we're having these experiences where we learn through imitation, and our first experiences are learning through our family, you know, and then our early experiences in adolescence through our first puppy love, and then in young adulthood through our first love experiences. And it's like this like process where it's like we're wandering around in the dark and just knocking shit over and breaking things and having our heart broken and breaking hearts. And it's incredible that we survive the process because it's so fraught with opportunities to be destroyed. So having been destroyed enough times, even by at that point when we were writing that record, like I was saying before, it had occurred to me that if this person existed for me, she was probably going to be something that I had never experienced before and probably wouldn't see coming, to the point of being like an anomaly. So I gave her a name. Her name was Anna Molly.
Yeah, that's great. That's fascinating. So I know we have a short period of time and there's so much to talk about, but you have your tour that you're going to be touring, and you're going to be touring for many, many months. So everybody out there, you'll get a great chance to see Incubus and doing the 23rd anniversary of their great album. That's Morning View. And so now, and you also have the reimagined album. So I know we have a very short time, but tell us a little bit about how you all came together and thought of that idea.
Well, again, that was something that like, when we first started talking about it, like I was kind of skeptical of it. just kind of because it was like, maybe it seemed like, why would we do that again? What's the point? But
I agree, Mike. I was in the same place as you. Sorry.
Yeah,
continue.
But then when we played the Morning View album live for the first time at the Hollywood Bowl, it felt like really different. Playing the songs felt really different, and I think that just that informed like my perspective and made me excited about the idea. Plus, also having a new band member, Nicole Rowe, our bass player, she's just amazing. Incredible energy, and it just seemed like it was fun. And I think I got over the stigma of like, oh, this is cheesy or whatever. Like, it's our fucking music. We can do whatever the fuck we want with our own music. Why is that cheesy? Why is it cheesy for us to play our own songs, like that we wrote? Like, we're the ones who decide that. So it was kind of empowering in a way. And
by the way, on that point, I've often wondered. The, you know, songs are not static creatures, right?
No, they're living, organisms that evolve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you were totally different people. Well, I'm not necessarily totally different people, but you were very different people at the time. You were kids at the time, and now you're no longer kids. And so it's an evolution, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the original versions will always be there in their original form. So when people come up and say like, why did you change this or change that? It's like, I don't fucking care. Go listen to the old one. It's still there. Sorry, I'm insensitive. I'm insensitive about that.
It's your music.
Yeah. It's our music. It's our music. We can do what the fuck we want with it. Too bad.
Well, and again, like you guys were never trying to fit into any cookie cutter mold to be successful.
We're trying to fit into the cookie cutter mold of what we are for better or worse.
And there's no cookie cutter for that. Yep. So guys, what are you listening to now in your playlist?
Blackpink. I have 7-year-old daughters. All they want to listen to is Blackpink. So, you know, Kill This Love and Pink Venom. Those are my jams. Hey, Brandon, those songs slap, no cap, on God, dead ass.
I got to say, that was unexpected for Mike. Yeah.
I got to say, too, that, like, Kill This Love and How You Like That, that song is fucking awesome. That song is like, yeah.
I'm on a completely different trip. I need to check that stuff out because Mike, you've been singing their praises for the last year or so. But I've been going backwards. I'm on a full Lee Hazelwood trip right now. Mike, do you know Lee Hazelwood's music?
Boring.
Lee Hazelwood is great.
Boring. Just kidding. I'm just joking.
His voice, what an incredible voice.
And
man.
Velvet Morning. That song.
Yeah, Some Velvet Morning.
Some Velvet Morning.
Mike, I'm gonna make you a playlist, Mike, of Lee Hazelwood. He does like duets with like Nancy Sinatra and stuff.
I just can't wait. I can't wait for you to be a dad, Brandon. I can't wait.
Some Velvet Morning is like revolutionary, actually, the way that it's it's a wild song. Yeah. That's one of our favorites, by the way.
Oh, nice. Mikey, I'm just warning you, I've been angling for Incubus to cover Some Velvet Morning since Nicole's been in the band. Her and I do the duet. Like, you'll love this track. It's awesome. Amazing. And Lee Hazelwood, just the reason I think I resonate so much with him right now is because if my voice ages like his does, like, I should be so lucky. To me, he sounds so good. Like, I love when people's voices like mature in a particular way, and his definitely did that. So that's what I'm listening to.
Brandon, I don't know if you know this. Have you heard Slow Dive's version of Some Velvet Morning?
I have, and I actually like it. I know it's been covered before, but Incubus hasn't covered it.
Yeah, well, we'll look forward to that. We'll look forward to that and Blackpink on the same album.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
For sure.
That'd be cool.
Right? Yeah.
Well, guys, listen, really excited to see you guys, listen to the new music. Everybody out there, go check it out. Really appreciate the story. Like, everybody out there got a kind of a rare thing because we talked about three different songs. So there were multiple journeys here, and that's what makes this a very special episode. Thanks for sharing all that, guys.
Yeah, we should play How You Like That with Nicole singing the vocal. It's a Blackpink song. It's a banger.
Love it. Okay, guys. Thanks for joining Story Behind the Song. Really enjoyed it.
All right, you guys.
Thank you so much.
Nice to meet you.
That was singer Brandon Boyd and guitarist Mike Einziger of the great band Incubus telling the story behind their classic tracks Drive and Wish You Were Here. I'm your host, Peter Chadi of Deep Cuts Media. Thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song, and stay tuned each Monday for another episode of new interviews mixed together with classic ones with icons like Heart, Boy George, Run DMC, and The Shins. And reach out to me at peter@deepcutsmedia.com if you want to add your own icons to that list. And make sure to like, subscribe, and share each episode and the show itself. And check out our Story Behind the Song merch on the Consequence website. And if you like the artwork for my podcast, you'll love the poster. I have one hanging right here in my studio. So until next week, revisit all of the great 40-plus interviews from seasons 1 and 2. The artists are legendary, and their stories are classic and timeless. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.